We're New Stock 1590 KBTA Ventura.
Following is a paid program. Gold Coast Broadcasting is not responsible for its content.
Toastmasters receives additional compensation for his participation during this paid program.
It's time now for Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle. Now, here's your host, Colin Fluxman.
Thank you and welcome. Today, our topic of discussion is domestic violence. Hi, Lisa and Tom, our regular guests on the
Hello,
show.
Hello, Colin.
Nice to see you again. And we have two special guests, Camarillo-based criminal defense attorney, former senior deputy DA and former professor of law at the Ventura College of Law, and Attorney of the Year 2011, Mark Packowitz.
Welcome. Good afternoon.
What does it mean to be Attorney of the Year?
That's an award that I received from the Ventura County Trial Lawyers Association following a case that I handled in Santa Barbara County against the County of Ventura.
Oh, interesting. And on the line we have clinical social worker and marriage and family therapist, Dr. Nancy Sattenberg. Welcome, Dr. Sattenberg.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
I understand that you were instrumental in bringing the Parents and Children Together PACT program to the San Fernando Valley, which you co-facilitated from 1993 to 2008 and retired from the court in 2008 to go into private practice, where you work exclusively with parents and children of separating and divorcing families. Tell us a little about the PACT program, if you will.
The PACT program was an educational program to try and get people, when they filed for divorce, to learn ways of communicating with each other from the beginning, to have good co-parenting, and it was educational to help them through that.
How effective was it?
It was actually very effective. It changed people's attitudes. I did my dissertation on it and found that people had a change in attitude just from a very brief 4-hour program.
As I said at the top of the show, we're dealing with domestic violence, and I have some startling statistics on the subject. Every 9 seconds in the U.S., a woman is assaulted or beaten. That's about 6 per minute. Around the world, at least 1 in every 3 women has been beaten, coerced into sex, or otherwise abused during her lifetime. Most often, the abuser is a member of her own family. Domestic violence is the leading cause of injury to women, more than car accidents, muggings, and rapes combined. Studies suggest that up to 10 million children witness some form of domestic violence annually. Domestic violence has an effect on the economy as well. Victims lose nearly 8 million days of paid work per year in the U.S. alone. That's the equivalent of 32,000 full-time jobs. Dr. Sattenberg, those figures are really eye-openers, aren't they? What are some of the factors that lead perpetrators to resort to domestic violence?
Some of it is systemic, where they have had it in their own families, and so this is what has been modeled for them, both for the perpetrator and for the victim. Also, some of it comes from low self-esteem for both parties, where maybe the woman feels or the victim feels that they deserve it, and so they expect it to happen. And sometimes the perpetrator also has low self-esteem, and this is how they feel powerful. But there are lots of different kinds of abuse other than physical. So there are ways to have domestic violence without it being physical.
Could you give us some examples?
Yes. There is emotional abuse, and there is isolation, where a party may isolate the victim and not allow them to see their friends or their families. There is intimidation, where they break things, that give looks and gestures. There's economic abuse, where they control the money and make all the decisions. There is minimizing or blaming, or where they deny the abuse ever happened and make people feel like, you know, there's something wrong with them. So those are some of the other ways. I also would, you know, just like to clarify that there are men who are abused too.
Yes.
It's probably not as common, and it's not as out in the open, because men are ashamed of it and embarrassed, and they keep it a secret.
That's because they feel they should be the stronger party, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Domestic violence seems to be just as much about emotional well-being as physical safety. How can a victim deal with the fallout of having been abused?
Well, they can go to shelters. There are places in counties where women can get help, or, you know, it's because it's mostly for women. The shelters are mostly for women.
Yes.
Many times they have been isolated from their families, and sometimes they don't even feel safe to go to their families. But those are things they need to get support. They need to have a support system, and they need to get away from it. I know that they get restraining orders many times, but the rate of recidivism where they go back to the abuser is very high, just because they have nowhere else to go.
Right. Mark, if I can turn to you now, what is the legal definition of domestic violence, and how seriously do the courts view it?
Well, first, the courts take it very serious, and I think everybody in the legal system, whether it's a prosecutor, defense attorneys, family law attorneys, take domestic violence very, very seriously, because we know how it affects society. We see those statistics in person. Domestic violence abuse, as the term is, pertains to intentionally or recklessly causing or attempting to cause great bodily injury, sexual assault, placing a person in reasonable fear of imminent bodily injury, or kind of a catch-all phrase of molest, attack, hit, stalk, threaten, batter, or harass an individual.
Based on reports from 10 countries, between 55% and 95% of women who had been physically abused by their partners had never contacted non-governmental organizations, shelters, or the police for help. Why is that?
Well, I think it's what the doctor talked about. It is a system and a situation that they find themselves in where they're afraid to contact people for fear that no one will believe them, for fear that there will be retaliation and reprisals. Sometimes it's an economic situation where a victim feels, if I have this person arrested and they go to jail, they're going to lose their job, I'm going to lose my house.
So they'd rather be subjected to the violence than have to face the possibility of losing the economic stability.
I think in certain situations it becomes a balancing situation and a decision that they have to try to make.
And what are the legal remedies for a victim of domestic violence?
Well, there's a lot of remedies and there's a lot of places for them to go. There's coalitions that are available for people to go to. Within the court system, one of the things that they can do is obtain a restraining order to protect themselves or protect their children or other people that may be affected. When law enforcement gets involved, obviously the perpetrator can be prosecuted.
Right.
As a result, placed on probation, ordered to pay restitution, pay medical bills, pay lost wages, and things like that.
Dr. Satenberg, children are often subjected to abuse, either physically themselves or emotionally, having seen their parents as victim and perpetrator. What are some of your experiences?
With the children?
Yes.
It's very disorienting for children. It's scary for them to see their parents out of control. It diminishes, parents are the children's protectors, and so it diminishes the role of protector. It threatens the child's loss of stability and increases their feelings of being abandoned. It can impact the child's sense of self and doubting the part of him or herself that's like the other parent. They learn very poor conflict resolution skills because the parents model for the children how to behave. And children at some point will begin to imitate their parents' conflictual style. And they deny their own feelings sometimes just because they want to appease an upset parent.
Is there a particular age group where women are at greater risk? Younger women, perhaps, or older women?
I don't really know whether there is a particular age group. I think it really has to do with the dynamics of what's going on mm-hmm. in the family, what they've been, exposed to. Some women stay in relationships for years, in marriages for years, where this has been going on, and they don't ever leave for some of the reasons that Mark said.
Yes. Mark, you mentioned remedies, and I'd like to address the Emergency Protective Order. What is the EPO, as it is known?
Well, an EPO is an order that, if the police come out, can be issued immediately to a perpetrator to immediately protect an individual, give them some sense of security.
What types of relief can a client seek from the judge with a domestic violence restraining order, and how can this order help the victim?
Well, one of the things that happens either through contacting an attorney who's going to go file the paperwork or going to the self-help clinic or doing it yourself, you can get online. There's great resources online. Through the Ventura County Superior Court, it has a packet basically of information that you would fill out. Not only can you get protection, but oftentimes this act of domestic violence will be the first act in a divorce.
Right.
And there are things that have to be dealt with immediately: custody of the children, support, spousal support, child support. And the process allows for people who apply for a restraining order to seek orders on all of that stuff, to protect themselves, to protect the children, obtain child support orders, child custody orders, prevent people from leaving the jurisdiction or the city.
Do I need a lawyer, or does one need a lawyer to get a restraining order?
You don't need a lawyer. Like I said, you can get online and find basically all of the forms that you need to fill out in order to go get an attorney. Do I think that's the best way to go? Not if you can afford it. Then I think you're better off having an attorney help you through the system to make sure that you get all that you're entitled to receive and you have obtained all the protection you're entitled to obtain.
We're discussing in Divorce Lisa Zonder Style domestic violence. If you have any questions, then you're free to, you're welcome to email us at lisa@divorcetalkradiocalifornia.com.
Are you and your spouse contemplating a divorce? Divorce is very stressful and can present a minefield of obstacles. Lisa Zonder is a divorce attorney and mediator. She can help you through this process, providing a number of alternatives to court, such as mediation and collaborative divorce with a professional team. Lisa's main office is on Townsgate Road in Westlake Village. She also serves mediation clients in her satellite office on Camden Drive in Beverly Hills. One call to Lisa will set you on the path to a peaceful and economical resolution that is focused on your family. Call 805-777-7740 or go online at zonderfamilylaw.com. Contact Lisa Zonder today, certified family law specialist, State Bar of California, Board of Legal Specialization. Call 805-777-7740 or go online at zonderfamilylaw.com. If you mention you heard it on the radio, your first consultation is free for local and qualified clients. Call 805-777-7740. That's Lisa Zonder, 805-777-7740, or email lisa@zonderfamilylaw.com. Consultations are granted based on appropriate qualification as determined by Lisa Zonder. Her practice is limited to family law matters in Ventura County and Beverly Hills.
You're listening to Divorce Lisa Zonder Style. I'm Colin Fluxman. In the studio, Camarillo-based criminal defense attorney, former senior deputy DA Mark Packowitz, and on the line we have Dr. Nancy Sattenberg. Lisa, you wanted to add something.
I did. You know, when Mark was just referencing some of the temporary orders that can be issued when an abused person seeks a domestic violence restraining order, there are a menu of options available to the applicant and that are within the power of the judge to grant. And the menu of options would include asking for exclusive use of a residence, possession or control of any animal owned or held by either of the parties, or it could be ordering the abuser to be removed from the home that they're both living in, even if that person is not necessarily on title. They could prohibit the abuser from possessing or purchasing a firearm. And also the court can make orders on child and spousal support on an interim basis. The spousal support would be if they're married, and other things that could be dealt with. So if you need, for example, temporary possession of things like your home computer, your vehicle, the court can make orders on that on an interim basis, and also ask the abuser, the judge can order the abuser to pay ongoing debts associated with some of the carrying charges like the house and the vehicle, et cetera. And the person who's applying for the restraining order also can indicate that they want some reimbursement for money they lost if they missed work because they were hospitalized, for example, or they had other expenses like ambulance, medical, need for shelter if they had to leave the home on an emergency basis because they were being abused. The court could look at their hotel costs and potentially order that reimbursed. I don't know, Mark, if you want to add anything here.
No.
Dr. Satenberg, we've discussed abuse, women and their husbands and the involvement of the children, etc. What about elder abuse? Perhaps we can have input from everybody here. What is the extent of elder abuse in your experience in that area?
Well, I really only work with people in divorce situations. Mm-hmm. I just know that there is elder abuse, that elders, you know, people abuse their, when elder people get dependent upon them or begin to have dementia and not think clearly, it gets frustrating sometimes for caretakers. And out of their frustration, they will abuse these people that really have no way of fighting back or even advocating for themselves.
Well, a person being abused over 65, for example, could be a case of elder abuse, right?
Yes.
That's correct. And there is different programs, and of course they can contact the police, but Adult Protective Services can become involved, and there are special types of crimes that pertain to elder abuse, financial, for example, and that's a different way to charge a theft against a person of a specific age is a separate crime that can be committed and be charged, and the prosecutors have the authority to charge either or both.
If a husband is stalking a wife, I guess that is also abuse, is it not?
Yes, it is. And it could be considered grounds for a restraining order, or it can also, depending on the conduct, be grounds for criminal charges.
Mark, is arrest mandatory if the police have probable cause to suspect that a domestic violence has occurred?
In Ventura County, there's no doubt that if there is probable cause to believe that a crime occurred, especially a crime of domestic violence, the individual is going to be arrested.
And what are the other consequences of a domestic violence charge?
There are a lot of consequences. The first one is you're taken to jail. The second is you have to figure a way to get out of jail, usually by posting bail, depending on the charge, whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony. That amount can change depending on the particular penal code section that they use to charge you. Your bail can be $20,000, it can be $50,000 or more.
You mentioned misdemeanor and felony in abuse as far as domestic violence is concerned. What is the difference between the two?
Usually it's broken down based on the type of conduct that has been engaged in by the perpetrator.
So a slap would be a misdemeanor perhaps, and a beating would be a
correct,
felony?
Correct. And oftentimes it looks at both the conduct, the injury, and prosecutors can make a decision, and as can the police. If this is the first time that something happened and it's a push, they may end up saying this is a misdemeanor. If this is the 50th time they've been to the residence and they've broken up four fistfights, it's going to be a felony.
Right. Lisa, you've mentioned over the weeks and the months that this is a no-fault divorce in California.
Correct.
So if a woman comes forward and says, my husband is beating me half to death, that's no cause for divorce, right? It's just irreconcilable differences, basically. Is that
right?
What
you don't need to prove up fault in order to get the divorce. You
right.
don't have to go there to get a divorce.
Right.
The court can terminate status just because there are irreconcilable differences.
And that's
it
one
might
of them,
affect
right?
other aspects of a divorce case. For example, support or custody.
Could you go into that a little?
Yeah, I can. But it's not something where you need to terminate marital status. You don't need to say I've been beaten. That's not
right.
required. So that's a good thing. But in terms of the other avenues that you could introduce evidence of domestic violence, there are statutes that specifically address if someone is convicted of domestic violence, there are support presumptions that go into effect.
I see. So that is so, very much affected.
So it can affect spousal support because, I mean, in theory, we're not trying to make somebody who's a victim pay spousal support. So you have a family code section that says that when there's a criminal conviction of domestic violence, there's a rebuttable presumption that convicted person can't get spousal support. I mean, imagine if that weren't true.
I see.
Before that law was enacted, mm-hmm. I mean, you can literally get beaten to a pulp and still have to pay that person's support. Doesn't sound too appealing.
Right.
So that's a statute that we have on the books in terms of spousal support. And also you had asked me how it is impacting and, you know, how does domestic violence impact a divorce? You also have similar concerns around child custody. Obviously, where there is domestic violence, whether it's from between the parents or affecting the child, it's going to create some rebuttable presumptions about whether custody is it's in the best interest of the person who perpetrated domestic violence to have that child for legal custodial purposes or physical custodial purposes. So there's a Family Code Section 3044 that comes into effect. But the one thing I would say is before the court even gets to that, they're going to look at the report and recommendation in Ventura County. Remember, we've talked about this through
a
lot of our shows.
Absolutely.
That they make recommendations in Ventura County. So the parents are going to go see the child custody recommending counselor, which used to be called mediator, but that's not truly what they are, because they're making a recommendation, the mediator. It's a mental health professional who's going to interview both parents and take into consideration the allegations of domestic violence, and then they're going to look at the best interests of that child in all those cases. Did you want to add anything to that, Mike?
No, the only thing that I wanted to finish up on is after a person's arrested, if they're prosecuted and they're eventually convicted, the consequences there can affect their immigration status. They would be placed on probation. They may do jail time. There will be fines. There will be money that they have to pay to domestic violence coalitions, places like that. And obviously, it'll affect their ability to get a job in the future. It is a very significant thing, and there are very significant consequences. There's domestic violence classes that they'll have to take as a result of a conviction.
Maybe we could talk about that, too, that 52-week program.
Yeah, there's as part of probation, if you're convicted, you have to go to the court and continue to prove that you've attended a 52-week class on domestic violence.
Yeah, and
is that monitored in any way?
Yes, it is by the courts. And a person who's convicted in Ventura County, for example, will have a 30-day review. They'll have to be back in court 30 days after they've been convicted, and they'll be back a month later or 3 months later, depending on the progress that they're showing. Obviously, the more they come in and show that they're doing the things that they need to do, the less monitoring that happens. The more that they're not going with the program, they're not paying their fees, they're not going to class, they're not doing the things that the court and the law demands that they do, the more they'll be monitored. And if they continue to do it, there'll be punishments added on for not doing the things that they're supposed to do.
You're listening to Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle on AM 1590 KVTA. And when we come back, Mark has several stories about a woman faking a domestic violence injury.
Going through a divorce is never easy. It's not only emotionally draining, but the many financial decisions can add to your stress. For over 25 years, Ventura-based Stephen Wagner, certified financial planner of Wagner Financial, has been helping people just like you make smart decisions when emotions can sometimes get in the way. From planning your retirement income to investment management, Steve Wagner can create a roadmap that you can understand and follow as you embark on your new life. In addition to providing clients with access to informative financial content and useful tools, Wagner Financial will make you feel more confident about your financial stance now and in the future. Call 805-339-0760 for an appointment. That's 805-339-0760 or log on to WagnerFinancial.com. For that one-on-one personalized financial attention, call Steve Wagner Financial on 805-339-0760. 805-339-0760. Stephen H. Wagner is an investment advisor representative with Transamerica Financial Advisors, as well as securities and investment advisory services offered through TFA, member FINRA, SIPC, and a registered investment advisor. Wagner Financial is not affiliated with TFA.
Have you already filed for divorce and are overwhelmed by the process? Or you're in the midst of a divorce and not sure what to do next? Well, we have the answer for you. The Second Saturday Divorce Workshop. Explore the legal, financial, and emotional aspects of divorce. Discover community resources available to help you. Talk with others experiencing similar life changes. Learn from the experts who have guided others through divorce. Divorce educational and informational workshops are held at Ventura College of Law, 4475 Market Street in Ventura, on the second Saturday of each month from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Register by calling 805-372-1810. That's 805-372-1810. Or email us at secondsaturdaywestlake@gmail.com. That's 2ndsaturdaywestlake@gmail.com. Call 805-372-1810. 805-372-1810. Please do not phone the law school. Registration is through our Second Saturday website. We look forward to answering your questions.
You're listening to Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle on AM 1590 KVTA. Lisa, we've spoken at length about dirty tricks in divorce. Mark, I understand that you have some stories about women faking a domestic violence injury?
I do. Actually, I have a number of them. You know, domestic violence, let me say, as a prosecutor, I saw it a lot. And I saw people who I was absolutely convinced had been the victim and refused to admit that they were the victim of domestic violence. Since leaving the district attorney's office, I've come into contact with a number of people who were accused of committing crimes of domestic violence. And unfortunately, in some cases, obviously not all, people have engaged because they realize there are ramifications. Like Lisa talked about, there can be a rebuttable presumption affecting spousal support. There can be presumptions that take place regarding child custody. So it can be a very big game changer. And unfortunately, many divorce proceedings begin with an accusation of domestic violence. One situation that comes to mind, there was already a divorce proceeding. There was discussions about what would happen, what the temporary orders would be, and then there was an allegation of domestic violence. Pictures were shown, which we sought to obtain through the civil proceeding, through the divorce proceeding. My client was charged. We tried to obtain the photographs through the criminal process, through discovery, and we didn't want the photographs. What we wanted was the digital image that was taken that had all the metadata, which would tell us what date the photo was taken, what time the photo was taken, to see if that would coincide with the allegations that had been made, which we believe were not true. They said they didn't exist. They had given them to the police. The police said they didn't get them. We went back and forth in both cases trying to find them. We eventually received something that had a file name of A, which was not the name that any file taken with a digital phone would have. And not only that, the rest of the metadata showing the date, the location, the type of camera that was used was all erased. Eventually, the client was found not guilty by a jury. Eventually, there was a hearing in which one of the persons, the victims, alleged victims' friends came in and took the fifth regarding whether or not she was involved in creating the injuries, in essence, on the victim. That individual, my client, was fortunate not only to be found not guilty, but eventually to be found factually innocent, which meant that the charges, the police reports, the court records were sealed from that incident. And there's been others like it. Another case I was involved in, an individual accused my client of going to her house to writing information on a wall. We used a handwriting expert to show that it was actually her that wrote the material on the wall that she said he did. There's a lot, unfortunately, There's a lot of negative ramifications that come from that. One of the things that happens immediately, and this kind of ties into something we talked about on one of the breaks, when you have these different proceedings, let's say there's a divorce going on, and then there's a temporary restraining order that's sought. Assuming the judge grants that temporary restraining order, it gets set for a hearing. But if the police end up prosecuting a client and that client comes to me, I'm going to tell that client, you're not talking to anybody until we deal with the criminal case first.
Right.
That means that we have to then deal with the restraining order hearing that's supposed to be set. We end up basically continuing that restraining order hearing, and a lot of issues negatively affect the entire divorce process because one side is now basically in a court battle with one hand tied behind their back, and they're not really in a position to defend themselves as much as they would like.
I would add to that that there are two tracks. So you're dealing with the family court track where the divorce is pending and that restraining order hearing, and then you're dealing with the track also that Mark's referring to, which is the criminal where you're trying to, the criminal proceeding where you're trying to defend your client. So literally, in the family law proceeding, you may, as a criminal defense attorney, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, you may instruct your client not to go to child custody mediation until the criminal case is resolved. You may be instructing that client not to testify in a deposition regarding anything that might implicate, you know, your rights in the criminal trial. So literally, you have to take a lot of precaution in dealing and advising with that client in the family law proceeding because there are rights that could be compromised in the criminal proceeding. So you've got two tracks going on. And I think that's what Mark's alluding to there, is that, you know, we have to be really careful how we go forward. So the domestic violence temporary restraining order, if criminal charges are filed, might actually get continued and kicked down the road quite a long way until the criminal proceeding is resolved.
Dr. Satenberg, you're still on the line, right?
Yes.
We spoke about dirty tricks and people making up stories about abuse, etc. Would it be advisable to keep a journal, perhaps, and talk to a therapist while this is going on?
For the victim? Alleged abuser?
Well, both. Let's discuss both of them.
Okay. Yeah, I think for the alleged abuser, it would be very good to help them. It actually would be good for both of them to be talking to somebody. The person who is making the allegations needs to look at what they're doing and why they're doing it and what they're hoping to gain by it, because it's very inappropriate to allege things about somebody that aren't true, and they're using it to their advantage, because in the court of law, at least my experience, when somebody is accused of that, they immediately, it stops everything and makes it, puts a little bit of a dark shadow on the whole proceeding for the person who has been abused. So that person needs support and help in terms of dealing with something that they've been accused of that they haven't done. And the other person, you need to work with them to find out why they're doing this and what they're hoping to gain, and how it really is setting such a poor example for the children.
Yes.
And for other people around them. I mean, in a divorce situation, the first thing that goes, in my experience, is the trust anyhow. So when that happens, it just sets the stage for a very bad, contentious divorce.
Can both parties to an altercation be charged with domestic violence?
They can. So sometimes what you may see is they both get arrested. The reality of the situation is if two people are in the house together and you arrest both of them, they're both going to probably say, I'm going to invoke my right to remain silent, and then no one wants to testify and no one gets prosecuted.
Right. Would one need a criminal attorney such as yourself if a spouse seems willing to drop the charges, so to speak, against the other?
Dropping the charges is a very difficult process, because it's not really up to the person that's been abused to drop the charges. Many people want to say, this isn't going to happen again. There was a reason that this incident happened.
Because this is a criminal offense, right?
Criminal offense.
Right.
And so it's the government that really decides mm-hmm. whether to continue to pursue this action or not.
Right. It becomes very, very involved, doesn't it, Lisa? Especially, you know, we're dealing with divorce and he said, she said situation and physical evidence is needed. It becomes very involved.
Yeah, you bring up a good point when you said physical evidence is needed. So I think we should also talk about why these sometimes you could apply for a domestic violence restraining order and why a judge might deny the request. Because mm-hmm. there are instances where they're denied. It's not frequent, but it does happen. Sometimes these DVTROs, as we call them, the acronym for short, the Domestic Violence Temporary Restraining Order, sometimes they're denied because there's not sufficient proof. So if you're lacking proof, a court could deny the request. Also, if you have insufficient detail regarding the recent incidents of abuse, that could be a basis for a court to deny your request for a restraining order. There are certain people, categories of people who qualify for a domestic violence restraining order. So, for example, if you're not in a married or dating relationship or don't meet the criteria for a domestic violence restraining order, you may be looking at some other type of restraining order. So, as an example, if your neighbors, you might be looking at a civil harassment restraining order. Or if it's a person over 65 who's being abused or isolated or neglected, it might be, like you referred to earlier, an elder abuse restraining order situation.
Right.
So those are really important things to think about when you submit your application. Also, if you give the court handwritten documents that aren't legible and they can't make out your complaint or your basic allegations, they could say, sorry, can't read this. So you got to be careful in doing the paperwork. And if the facts that are set forth in your declaration or your form aren't based on your personal observation, what we call hearsay, essentially, a court will likely deny that as well until you have something, some declaration or supporting evidence from a percipient witness. So those are important things to think about just in terms of your application being granted or denied.
In practical terms, from a criminal perspective, husband and wife are in an altercation, an argument, and he slaps her. Now, she calls the police, says, I'm being subjected to domestic violence. They come, responding to her call. Do they arrest him, or do they have to figure out what happened, and do they look at the situation or immediately take him in? What happens?
Now, the police are obligated to look at the situation and try to determine the best that they can what actually happened. And they usually do that by trying to talk to both sides.
Right.
Any witnesses, obviously, if there's anyone else in the home. Unfortunately, oftentimes that's children who then have to provide their account of what happened. They look for physical evidence. Are there marks that are consistent or inconsistent with the abuse that's been alleged? And then they make a decision based on the information that's before them what to do. And if they believe they have probable cause, then they usually arrest somebody.
So what happens after the arrest? They take him to the cells, they lock him up, or they charge him? What happens?
He's taken to jail. He has the opportunity generally to post bail. After that, he'll have a court date. That date is based on whether he remains in custody or he's released. When he goes to court, the district attorney's office will have already received the police reports from the police agency, and then they make a decision based on the information they have, what, if any, crime occurred, and what evidence do they have to prove it.
You're listening to Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle on AM 1590 KVTA.
Are you and your spouse contemplating a divorce? Divorce is very stressful and can present a minefield of obstacles. Lisa Zonder is a divorce attorney and mediator. She can help you through this process, providing a number of alternatives to court, such as mediation and collaborative divorce with a professional team. Lisa's main office is on Townsgate Road in Westlake Village. She also serves mediation clients in her satellite office on Camden Drive in Beverly Hills. One call to Lisa will set you on the path to a peaceful and economical resolution that is focused on your family. Call 805-777-7740 or go online at zondafamilylaw.com. Contact Lisa Zonder today, certified family law specialist, State Bar of California, Board of Legal Specialization. Call 805-777-7740 or go online at zondafamilylaw.com. If you mention you heard it on the radio, your first consultation is free for local and qualified clients. Call 805-777-7740. That's Lisa Zonder, 805-777-7740, or email Lisa at zonderfamilylaw.com. Consultations are granted based on appropriate qualification as determined by Lisa Zonder. Her practice is limited to family law matters in Ventura County and Beverly Hills. Have you already filed for divorce and are overwhelmed by the process? Or you're in the midst of a divorce and not sure what to do next? Well, we have the answer for you. The Second Saturday Divorce Workshop. Explore the legal, financial, and emotional aspects of divorce. Discover community resources available to help you. Talk with others experiencing similar life changes. Learn from the experts who have guided others through divorce. Divorce educational and informational workshops are held at Ventura College of Law, 4475 Market Street in Ventura, on the second Saturday of each month from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Register by calling 805-372-1810. That's 805-372-1810. Or email us at secondsaturdaywestlake@gmail.com. That's 2ndsaturdaywestlake@gmail.com. Call 805-372-1810. 805-372-1810. Please do not phone the law school. Registration is through our Second Saturday website. We look forward to answering your questions. Going through a divorce is never easy. It's not only emotionally draining, but the many financial decisions can add to your stress. For over 25 years, Ventura-based Stephen Wagner, certified financial planner of Wagner Financial, has been helping people just like you make smart decisions when emotions can sometimes get in the way. From planning your retirement income to investment management, Steve Wagner can create a roadmap that you can understand and follow as you embark on your new life. In addition to providing clients with access to informative financial content and useful tools, Wagner Financial will make you feel more confident about your financial stance now and in the future. Call 805-339-0760 for an appointment. That's 805-339-0760, or log on to wagnerfinancial.com. For that one-on-one personalized financial attention, call Steve Wagner Financial on 805-339-0760. 805-339-0760. Stephen H. Wagner is an investment advisor representative with Transamerica Financial Advisors, as well as securities and investment advisory services offered through TFA, member FINRA, SIPC, and a registered investment advisor. Wagner Financial is not affiliated with TFA.
You're listening to Divorce Lisa Zonder Style on AM 1590 KVTA. With us in the studio is Mark Packabitz, who is a criminal defense attorney, and on the line, Dr. Nancy Sattenberg, who has worked with parents and children together in a program in the San Fernando Valley, which she co-facilitated for a number of years, retired from the court in 2008 to go into private practice, where she works exclusively with parents and children of separating and divorcing families. I have a question. You may or may not have an answer to this, Nancy, but if you're able to answer, that would be interesting. I understand that men who as children witnessed their parents' domestic violence were twice as likely to abuse their own wives than the sons of non-violent parents. Have you heard of that?
Well, I said before that it is sometimes a systemic problem where this is what they've grown up with, this is what was modeled for them. Sometimes I see it work the opposite way, where men saw their dads abusing their moms and they don't abuse, but in other situations it works just like you're saying.
Right. Let's look at safety plans and parenting plans, if you will. What kind of safety plans can be put into place?
Okay. In parenting plans, when there is domestic violence, everything should be very specific. There should be nothing left that is left for people to work out on their own or less flexible. They should have something that they can follow to a T so that there's no doubt about how things should go. Because the abusers sometimes can use a flexible parenting plan to continue to abuse the other parent, because they will just make it so that they can do whatever they want to do and it's a way of them continuing to have control over the situation. So when I did parenting plans in domestic violence situations, first of all, there was never any pickup or drop-off at the other parent's residence. It was very important. Ideally, if the children are of school age, it's really good for them to have no physical contact and to do the exchanges at the school so that they don't have to have any kind of tension between them that the children witness, and it can just be a much more comfortable exchange. But if that's not possible because their children are not old enough or they don't exchange on a Friday or on a school day, then it's important that they meet in a public place and that they do not have any long conversations that could possibly escalate and become a problem, that they just keep it very polite and simple, say hello, and just make it easy for the children. Then the alleged victim usually should leave first so that they can get away and not allege. I mean, and this protects both of them. If the alleged victim leaves first, then they can leave and be out of there, and there will never be any allegations that anything happened. If the alleged abuser leaves first, then the victim can say that this person waited for them and that there were problems at the exchange. So it's very important for the alleged victim to leave first. As I said, it protects both of them.
Right.
Dr. Satenberg, let me ask you a question.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in your experience, this is for a couple that is still able to do an exchange. Wouldn't there also be some instances where the abuse is so so insidious, so bad, that actually there may be supervised visitation plans?
Absolutely.
So maybe we can just talk about the different types of outcomes that might exist. So in some, there may be no visitation at all.
Right.
In others, supervised visitation, and then others are more functional, and there can be exchanges with the parent.
Yes. But if there are, sometimes there are monitored situations, supervised visitation. Sometimes they take place at facilities where the children go to a facility and the person meets them there. Sometimes it's somebody that's hired that does the supervising of the visits, and this person then will be the one to pick the children up from the other parent and bring them back so that the parents have no contact at all. So there are different ways to do that. Any communication that the parents have, there's a website. There are several different kinds of ways that they can do that, but one that is very popular in the courts in Los Angeles is a website called Our Family Wizard, where parents communicate, and everybody, the judge can have access to it, the attorneys have access to it, therapists have access to it, and everybody sees what the communication is, so that any business that they have to conduct, they do on that. That's open for everybody to see.
I would jump in here and just suggest that sometimes the court will actually make that the order, is that there's no communication between the parents if there's abuse, except through a site like Family Wizard, where they go on and all of the communications are trackable by the courts and the counsel and the parents. So there's no, it takes out the he said, she said of what I said in a text or whether I sent this email, et cetera.
Right. And also, I think if there's regular emails, I think people can work with that and sort of make it, they can make changes on it, which they cannot do that on Our Family Wizard.
Well, not only can they make changes with it, there for texting or emails or phone calls, you can get online and there's websites that you can use to spoof emails. So, for example, I could have put in Lisa's phone number or her email address and send an email to somebody and have it look like it came from her. And that's obviously a huge concern in both proving your case or defending your case when it's based on text messages or emails at this point in time. And the other thing I would add is I think people, when there is a domestic violence allegation, whether it's true, whether it's not true, you need to protect yourself. In one of the situations I had, we decided that the allegation was not true. My client was convinced it was not true. We developed evidence to prove that it was not true, but we were convinced that she was not done. So we had my client wear a electronic monitoring device on his ankle for months because we knew that, you know, yes, it's a pain to do that. But if she came into court and said, he came to my house, we wanted to be able to prove that that was not true. And when we went to court and when she said he came to my house, my client and I looked at each other and he was finally happy for the first time in months that he was wearing that ankle bracelet, because at that point we knew we would be able to prove what turned out he was no closer than 14 miles from the residence at the time she said. So people need to, you know, what the doctor said, protect yourselves when you get there so that you don't get hurt, but also so that people don't make any accusations against you that are not true.
It's pretty scary that you have to, that people have to resort to these measures. And I'm sure you as a criminal defense attorney and you, Lisa, as a divorce attorney, and even Dr. Satenberg have come across so many dastardly things that people do. We mentioned dirty tricks and what husbands and wives and what wives will do, husbands will do just to hurt the other person, right?
That's true. And I think the one thing to walk away from, and I've been on both sides of the fence in the 25 years I've been an attorney, every case is different, and you can't be jaded, and you can't walk in and say everything one side says is true and everything the other side says is false. You have to really break down all of the information, analyze the information, and try to figure out what happened and how to best get from point A to point B, whether it's with a restraining order. Sometimes the restraining order is fantastic. It's needed in the very beginning. But after months of separation, the criminal case winds its way down. It either goes away or it's resolved. If it's dismissed, for example, then the only thing left is the restraining order. Sometimes you can handle that in a family law order where in the family law court, everybody agrees to not harass, not annoy. And if any party does that, then they would be violating that court order. The restraining order then goes away, and the difference is the restraining order is in the law enforcement system, and if you violate that order, it's a different, it's easier in essence to prosecute you.
In the break, we spoke about a temporary restraining order. Is that different from what we've been discussing now?
Yeah, just to be clear, so you can secure a domestic violence temporary restraining order, and that usually stays in effect for a few weeks until you're called back for a hearing. And so if the court then proceeds and both parties are ready to proceed on the temporary, on the return on the temporary hearing, what happens is the court will actually hear the case, listen to both sides, because before they were issuing usually just based on one side's application, the court will actually hold a hearing and then decide whether to issue a permanent restraining order. So at that point, you're looking at potentially having a permanent restraining order or having the temporary dissolved or continued. Those are usually the options you have when you get to a domestic violence temporary restraining order hearing.
Can these orders be contested? I mean, you know, you're given a restraining order and you feel that this is not fair. I know there is a process, an appeal process, but can it be contested?
It can. As soon as, like Lisa said, usually one side goes in, presents paperwork to the court issues a temporary order, and then they set a hearing for about 3 weeks out. At that hearing, you can present evidence. You will testify. You can call the other side to testify. If there are other witnesses that are available, you can subpoena records. You have access to a lot of different information that you can try to present to the court during that hearing to convince them on one side to either issue the restraining order and all of the other associated orders you're asking for, or to defend it and have the court decide that the order should not be issued.
Have people, in your experience, gone as far as putting monitoring devices in their homes, cameras, recording devices, just to prove that the partner is being abusive?
I think people, I haven't seen that as much, because if they're in the same house, everybody knows it. Phones now are everywhere, and they're used to grab a lot of information.
Yep, cameras on yes. the phones. Lisa, a couple of words from you before we wind up generally.
What would be interesting for me is to hear from Dr. Satenberg for clients of ours who are going through domestic violence, you know, matters, like how could they self-care? What can they do to help themselves emotionally?
Good question. Very good question.
It's important for them to get into their domestic violence support group that they can get into. They need to... it's good to go to a therapist and help them in terms of working through what's going on for them. If they're strong enough, it really would be good for them to leave the situation and get out of the situation. Sometimes they're not emotionally strong enough to do that. Sometimes even when they have the TRO, they don't go back and, you know, make it into a regular restraining order. And sometimes the DA will pick it up on their own, and they weren't even pursuing it. So the best thing really to do, I mean, I think that people sometimes will think that, well, if I only didn't do this or I only didn't do that, I wouldn't be abused.
We have about a minute to go. If I may ask generally, what are the kind of online resources that people have? You know, going to an attorney is not cheap. Going to a therapist, all of this costs money. What about those people who can't afford this and they are being subjected to this kind of violence and drama in their lives? Are there ways of handling and dealing with that?
Yes, there are. There are a number online, you said. Online, if you go to the Ventura County Superior Court website, they have a section on that website that will basically provide you with a packet of information, all of that you need to know about obtaining a restraining
right.
order. If you need assistance, you can also call the Ventura County District Attorney's Office. Years ago, a lady by the name of Ellie Liston, who was a victim advocate, established a way to do that.
Well, that's it. That winds it up for today. Thank you very much to our guests, and we'll be back next week at the same time.